Well, good morning. We are lacking a few people today because we have a good group of folks down at CYC in the Pigeon Forge area, and they are being enriched this morning. I know usually that worship service has about 10 to 13,000 people in attendance for that one weekend, and I bet the singing is phenomenal, and I have enjoyed our singing this morning so far from Paul. And I want to encourage you, tonight is our fourth Sunday night singing that we will be having in here at 5 o'clock, and where we will have numerous song leaders come up and sing songs of praise and songs of teaching and songs that are encouraging. And I want to encourage you to come back this evening and partake with us as we enjoy that. And we'll have a lesson from Travis this evening to go along with that as well. I am so thankful for all the different works that are happening here at Hilldale, for the wonderful women's ministry we have, for the wonderful children's ministry we have, for our men being involved. And I am thankful for that. And I am thankful for this year's theme of being a church that is in motion, having momentum as we go throughout the year. We want to continue to build and build and build and have this head of steam as we end our year and go into the next. And I am so thankful for the many different things we've done so far in these first 2 months. And throughout this month of February, we have been discussing how we can build marriage momentum. And I promise you, this is our last sermon on marriage today. Next month, we're going to be starting a series that I did last year on looking at verses in their original context, seeing how we can understand what is really being said. Some of them will be scriptures that are often misused and abused by society today, and some will just be scriptures that we often don't look at in its original context. So that will be starting next week, and so this week will be our final lesson on marriage. But as you heard Steve read our scripture this morning, in Mark chapter 3, verses 22 through 26, we're going to be talking about division. Now, division is an important thing in marriage, but it can also be applied to any sort of facet of our life, in our relationships with our friends, in our families, in the church. Division is such a key thing that we need to understand so that we can steer clear of it. But we are going to be talking about division and marriage today. I hope you grabbed a bulletin this morning. I spent some time putting in one of an outline in there. If you want to be able to take notes and follow along, you're more than welcome to use that bulletin outline. If it's going to cause you to be hindered at all, please don't use it. Focus on us and have an open Bible this morning as we go throughout this lesson. Now, I want everybody to look at that color. Now, some of you in here, when you first saw that color, and maybe these screens don't do it justice, but it's Tennessee orange. Now, a lot of you, these screens really don't do that justice, because that is a bright orange. Now, some of you in here probably started singing Rocky Top in your head and were thinking, I can't wait till next year's football season. I wonder what it's going to like. Some of you vomited in your mouth, because you don't like that color, because your color is either crimson or blue or orange and blue, or for the some out there that are gold for Vanderbilt, you don't like this color. And what's so funny, when I living in Alabama and growing up in Alabama, everybody always asks the question whenever you say, I'm from Alabama. The first thing they ask you is, oh, what team do you root for, Alabama or Auburn? Now, I was the black sheep of Alabama. I never liked either of those schools, really, because I grew up in Texas for some of my life. Both my parents were Texas A&M graduates, so I had the Aggie maroon in my mind for a while. And then I played football at Jacksonville State, which that's just kind of the oddball school in Alabama. But everybody would always do that, and as you would travel around Alabama, you would see numerous mailboxes that were half Auburn, half Alabama, and they would say a house divided on it. Sometimes you find that in Tennessee, right? Now, here's the interesting about Tennessee. Y'all have a lot of rivals. I don't understand who is your rival, and I don't think you understand who your rival is. If you look at the newest NCAA college sports video game, they have five different rivals for Tennessee. Georgia, Kentucky, Alabama, Florida, and Vanderbilt. Pick one. That way it would make it a lot easier for us to understand. But sometimes you can even buy these flags to hang out in front of your house to show that you are a divided home. One of you loves the Georgia Bulldogs, the others love the Tennessee Volunteers. I always love seeing families like this because then you like to see how they will go to their children and try to pull them over to, I'll buy you this sweet, awesome Georgia Bulldog sweatshirt and so you can wear it, and then that'll really make your mom upset. And so you see it happening in the family, and it's comical to watch it. And it's all fun and games when we start talking about which team we're divided over. But what's not fun in games is talking about marriage and division, right? Having the marriage between, a division between husband and wife, because that does more effects on children than having a favorite team or not. The big idea of our lesson today is going to be talking about how a marriage divided will not last. And we're going to be looking at Mark chapter 3, verses 22 through 26. And I please understand, we are going to be directly applying this to marriage. But there is a greater application that Jesus is trying to make here throughout these parables. That division anywhere causes destruction in any sort of relationship. And so maybe you're here this morning and you're single. Maybe you're here this morning and you are a widow or widower. Or maybe you are here this morning and you have a great marriage and there's no division in it. Please understand that this main principle that we're going to be talking about is that if you find division anywhere in your life, it will cause destruction wherever it is. Now, this morning, we're going to be looking at we're going to look at this lesson, and from it, we're going to learn the lesson, we're going to apply the lesson, and then we're going to live this lesson. Notice, number one, as we look at the lesson learned, look at this, these verses again with me as we read. And the scribes who came down from Jerusalem were saying, he is possessed by Beelzebul, by the prince of demons. He casts out the demons. And he called them to him and said to them in parables, how can Satan cast out Satan? If a kingdom is divided against himself, that kingdom cannot stand. And if a house is divided against itself, that house will not be able to stand. And if Satan has risen up against himself and he is divided, he cannot stand, but is coming to an end. As we look at this, I want you to understand the context of Mark chapter 3, starting in verse 22. Right? We need to understand what's happening in Mark 1 and Mark 2 and the beginning of Mark 3. Jesus starts off hot in the Gospel of Mark, right? He starts his ministry in verse 11 as he is baptized by John the Baptist. He's taken out into the wilderness. He comes in and he starts preaching. And along with that preaching and teaching, he's healing people, right? He heals a man with leprosy. He heals a man with unclean spirit. And all the while he's doing that, he's teaching. And guess who's hearing these teachings? Yes, the spiritually sick, but also the scribes and Pharisees. And from the very beginning, they are wanting to attack this man. They are wanting to figure out, what is this guy all about? Who is this that has this authority to preach this way? You'll see that towards the end of Mark chapter 1. At the beginning of Mark chapter 2, he heals the man who comes through the ceiling, right? This paralyzed man. And what does he say to him? Your sins are forgiven. And guess what he knew? As he knew these scribes and Pharisees were reasoning in their hearts about who is this guy that can forgive sins, right? They didn't like that, because towards the end of it, they started saying that he is blasphemous. They didn't like him at all. They didn't like what he was teaching. They didn't like what he was doing. And ever since then, really, they've been seeking a way to destroy him. I want you to look at Mark chapter 3, verse 6. After he heals this man with a withered hand on the Sabbath, right? He starts having this other discussion with him. Then these Pharisees realized, notice verse 6, they wouldn't be able to defeat him themselves. And so what do? The Pharisees went out immediately, held counsel, Herodians against him, how to destroy him. Now, that may not stick out to you that much, but you have to understand this relationship between these Jewish leaders of the Pharisees and the Herodians. The Herodians were a power that the Roman government gave these Jewish people. You've heard of Herod before. He was the quote-unquote king of the Jews, right? Put in power by the Roman government. The Pharisees and scribes did not like the Herodians because they were in a relationship with the Roman government. They disliked Jesus so much and what he was doing so much, they said, let's team up with them. We need to start recruiting people to destroy this guy. He's gaining a following. He's teaching things that we perceive are against us. So we need to go after him. Okay? Now that takes you down to here. And so they start bringing in, notice these scribes who came down from Jerusalem. Okay? What is housed in Jerusalem? The temple. These scribes are your top dogs, okay? These are the number one. This is like if you were to go to the Fried Hardeman University and take out all the Bible professors and everybody who was high up there and say, we need help to go destroy this guy. That's what they did. They went to the number one people and brought these big time scribes and Pharisees in to defeat this guy. And so what do they say? He is possessed by Beelzebub. Wow, oh, they just went in there big time, right? Now, sometimes you'll see it translated this way in the Hebrew, Baal Zebub, which is translated as the Lord of the Flies. But notice as they continue, as Mark keeps letting us know what they're saying, we figure out who they're really calling him or who he's really possessed by. He is possessed by the prince of demons. He casts out demons. Right? And then notice what Jesus says. And he called them to him and he said to them in parables, how can Satan? So when they are saying he's possessed by Beelzebub, they are saying he is possessed by Satan. And what they're saying is that he's doing all of these miracles, right? And you got to start thinking about these miracles. He's healing people, right? He's taking care of all these people. He's loving on these people. And so this must be Satan's work, is what they're saying. Seems a little ridiculous, right? But they were trying to do everything they could to destroy this man's reputation. And so they thought, let's just go ahead and tell everybody he is possessed by Satan himself. And so Jesus does as he often does, is he teaches in parables. And he starts off this teaching in parables by asking this question, how can Satan cast out Satan? I'm casting out unclean spirits. If I was Satan, why would I want to do that? Because notice verse 24, if a kingdom is divided against himself, that kingdom cannot stand. Notice he hones in a little bit more. He goes from a kingdom to a house. And if a house is divided against himself, that house will not be able to stand. And notice he narrows in a little bit more and he gets straight to the answer of this question. If Satan has risen up against himself and is divided, he cannot stand, but he is coming to an end. And when you look up that idea of coming to an end, it actually comes from the Greek word telos, which is this idea of perfect or maturity to completion, right? But it can also be seen in the negative sense of destruction. And that's what Jesus is saying. If Satan is working against himself, all he's going to do is to destroy himself. Now, do you think Satan is dumb enough to do that? No. And that's what Jesus is trying to tell these scribes and everybody listening to him, right? He starts out with this kingdom. If it's divided against himself, and he's kind of giving them an eye and letting them know, look what you Jews have done, right? You've divided God's kingdom, and this is what's happened to it. And if a kingdom is divided against himself, it cannot stand. Now, I want to make some application outside of our marriage. I want to talk about the church. If a church is divided, what does Jesus tell us is going to happen? It cannot stand. And maybe you've been a part of churches before where you've seen division, right? Why do you think Paul was so quick to write a letter to the church at Philippi? He saw division in that church family between Euodia and Syntyche. And so he wrote them a letter and let them know that they needed to be of one mind. They needed to agree in the Lord, because he knew if that division festered, what was going to happen to that church? It would split. How many times have we seen in our society today, maybe even near us, where we've seen divisions happen in churches? And what happens to the churches? They split. They fall apart. They wither. They are destroyed. Now, Christ's capital C church will never be destroyed. It'll never come to destruction. But sometimes we as humans get on our own high horses and get on our own pedestals, and we don't want to humble ourselves and to help others around us and to come to agreement on things that are outside of where Scripture has bound things. And because of that, destruction happens. The same thing happens in a home, right? And I love that Jesus does that. He starts with a kingdom, then he goes to a house. In this intimate relationship with family, if there is division in family, what happens to relationships? They're destroyed. If there is division between mother and father, what happens? It's destroyed. If there is division between parents and children, what happens? That relationship is destroyed. We want to make sure we don't have division. We want to make sure that we are united together. We want to make sure that we are humbling ourselves so that we can reason together. But then Jesus ends and said, if Satan has risen up against himself, he's divided and he won't be able to stand. But ultimately, he will destroy himself. And Jesus is trying to get them to understand, your argument is ridiculous. He would not destroy himself. And by the end of it, he's going to let them know that you are being blasphemous for trying to say that me using the Holy Spirit to work all these miracles and to teach all these things is actually a work of Satan, right? Now, what we ultimately learn is that division produces destruction. Apply that to everything in your life. Apply that to businesses. Apply that to your family. Apply that to your workplaces, your employees, to everybody involved, your relationships. Division produces destruction. But here's the bright side of it. And this is what you can see when you look at this and the implications of this. If division produces destruction, that means unity generates longevity. When you are unified, your relationships last longer. When you are unified, there is joy, there's happiness, there's communication, because unity will generate longevity. And that's what Jesus is trying to imply throughout this lesson, these parables that he's teaching these people. As they are trying to destroy him, he lets them know that, look, division produces destruction, but unity will produce longevity. Now, I want us to apply this lesson. I want you to listen to this story. It was a fascinating story. As I was reading about this, I thought, wow, how important is unity? In 1912, two rival expeditions set out on a dangerous journey to the South Pole. No, thank you. I'm not going down there. One team, led by the Norwegian explorer Roald Amundsen, achieved victory and returned home safely. The other, under the command of Robert Falcon Scott of Britain, faced disaster with every member perishing in the Antarctic wilderness. The key difference between them was not just luck or the harsh environment, it was unity versus division. Wise preparation versus poor planning, teamwork versus internal conflict. You see, Scott and his team, as they were preparing and as Scott was getting his group ready to go on their expedition, didn't pay much attention to the local life down there. He didn't look to the Inuit people and see how they were living their lives and how they navigated. And so because of that and his poor preparation, first off, he lost a lot of confidence from the men that were in his group. Second off, he took the wrong tools. He took ponies down there, okay? Not only that, he took motorized snowmobiles. Now you're thinking, 1912, that couldn't have been that great. They weren't. And so he took these things down there and didn't have proper planning to where to put supplies along the way. And because of that, they got down there with their ponies. And guess what? Have you ever looked at horses' hooves before? They will not do well in snow. And they didn't do well. And because of that, they had to get rid of the ponies and use them for another resource. Then they started using snowmobiles. Guess what happened to those snowmobiles? They broke down and had to ditch them. And so guess what they all had to resort to? Pulling all their stuff. No thanks. And because of that, it took them a lot longer. And because it took them a lot longer, they got caught in a blizzard. And ultimately, all of Scott's team died. But Amundsen and the Norwegian team, he spent numerous years studying the Inuit people, learning about what they wore, learning about how they traveled, learning about where to put supplies along the way so that they would have enough resources as they were going. His men gained confidence in him. They were unified in their decisions. Amundsen didn't waver on what he was going to do, which gave them even more confidence and caused them to trust him more. And so because they learned what the Inuit people do, they wore fur clothing. And because they wore fur clothing, they were a lot warmer. And not only that, they said, hey, these people travel by sled dogs. That's a good idea. And so they did. They got the best team of sled dogs they possibly could. And because of that, they were able to glide through the snow and make it to their destination and make it back. They were prepared. And because they were prepared, they were unified. And because they were unified, they all got back home safely and no one had any health issues. But yet we saw what happened with Division and Scott's team. This is actually supposed to be a picture of the tents that Scott's team used and were ultimately found in. You see, division will always cause destruction. As Jesus teaches, as we see applied in real life, and as we see applied in our own lives, division causes destruction. Anywhere it is, relationships are destroyed. Confidence is destroyed. But if we remember, unity will generate longevity. Now, as we look at our lesson lived today, I want to hone in on our marriages. And I want to apply these four different commitments to us. And I want you to make these commitments today to your spouse. Maybe you are without a spouse. Make these commitments to someone in your life and promise to do these things. Number one, pray together. There's a reason this is number one, as you can probably tell. Praying together as a husband and wife is so important. Paul will say in Philippians 4, 6 through 7, do not be anxious about anything, but in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be known to God. And guess what the peace of God will do? It'll be in your hearts. It'll be in your minds, and it will guard your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. Paul's talking to the church at Philippi. But can he also be talking to us in our marriages? Absolutely. So husbands and wives, pray together. Husbands, look to your wives and say, what is on your heart? What's on your mind? I would love to pray with you. Heather and I have tried to start doing that as much as we possibly can. And I'll be honest with you, I have failed numerous times at this. But you know what happens when we do pray together? Things are better. We're talking more about spiritual things in our lives. We're focused more on letting Jesus and God give us this peace and not me trying to rely on myself to provide this peace. Don't you want peace in your life? Don't you want peace in your marriage? Well, can I ask you to commit to praying together? And this week, I want you, and if you notice in your outlines, there's a little black box. I'm sure you can guess what that is because I also put in parentheses, check that box off at the end of the week. If you have prayed together, check that box off. I want to encourage you to do that. I want you to go home this weekend and strive to pray together. Let your children see you pray together. Next, another commitment I would love for you to make this week is to plan together. Notice what Paul says in Philippians 2, complete my joy by being of the same mind, having the same love, being in the full accord and of one mind. You can probably guess, as I've already alluded to, Philippians is a lot about becoming unified. And the way we become unified is by having the same goals, having the same mind, being on the same page, as we'll often say. We need to be on the same page in our marriage. How we're going to parent, how we're going to spend our finances, how we're going to do anything and everything in our lives, we need to be on the same page. I see some couples that will post at the beginning of the year where the husband and wife will go out and get coffee and they'll spend all day or all morning going through this document or documents of how they're going to plan out their year. That's awesome. That's not me. I will go ahead and tell you that. But Heather and I like to talk about this. We like to plan. We like to make sure that we have our finances in order so that we can plan trips because we love to go places. We love to make memories with our children. That's just not going to happen on a whim. We have to plan together because if we don't plan together, guess what? We're going to be not on the same page. And when you're not on the same page, you're not communicating well together, that's when division starts happening. Dad thinks I should parent the children this way. Mom thinks I should parent the children that way. That's not good. There's going to be a lot of clashing, right? Dad thinks we should save all this money. Mom thinks we should go and spend it, or vice versa. Guess what? That's not going to be good. So try to be on the same page. And while you're planning together, guess what you can do? There's this cool word called compromise, right? The big spenders in the family and the big savers in the family can say, hey, can we at least spend something on this? And the big saver could say, that would be a good idea. But guess what y'all have done? You've planned it, right? I want you this week to spend time with your spouse or somebody in your life planning out this week. Maybe you're not ready to plan a whole year. Start with this week. What are we going to eat this week, right? Boy, talk about division in a marriage, right? What are we going to eat tonight? No idea. I don't know either, okay? Plan out your meals for the week and start there. And then progress as you keep continuing in your relationship. Learn to then talk about, hey, how are we going to use our finances this month? Hey, what are we going to do this weekend? Hey, what are we going to do that weekend? And plan out your entire year. Next, another commitment I would love for you to make with one another is pursue God together. I've always loved the illustration where it will talk about how a husband and wife grow closer together when they each grow closer to God. And I love that because it's so true. I can be honest with you, the moments when Heather and I have struggles is when we're both not doing this together. When we are pursuing God together, it's awesome and it's wonderful. And so that's why we strive to make sure we're doing this. And it's a lot because guess what I'm doing all day? Preparing sermons, classes, praying, thinking about God. And so when I go home, guess what I love to do as well? This same thing. I want to encourage Heather in her walk with God. I want to encourage my young children in their walk with God. And so pursuing God together is so very important. And so I want to encourage you to do that very thing. Pursue God together. I don't know what that's going to look like. Maybe you want to go through and read a Bible passage together. Maybe you want to listen to a sermon together. You want to listen to a certain podcast together, or you want to start a specific devotional together. I just want to encourage you to pursue God together. Whatever that looks like in your family, I don't know, but do it. And make sure you're focused on this, because notice what Paul will say here in Philippians 8 through 9. Finally, brothers, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence, if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things. What you have learned and received and heard and seen in me, practice these things, and the God of peace will be with you. See, there's that peace word again. When I know that we are pursuing God together, guess what's going to happen in our marriage? There's going to be peace because there's going to be unity. And unity will generate longevity. And it will help our relationship. So I want to encourage you, and maybe you just take this passage and you memorize it together. And you try to learn this passage by the end of the week, and you're focusing on these different things. Then maybe next week, you take that first phrase, whatever is true, and you focus on that throughout the week. Let's focus on things that are true. Let's focus on the truth this week. And then the next week, you say, let's focus on what is honorable. And you can use that for numerous weeks of studies together. Because I want to encourage you to pursue God together. And the last thing, I want you to praise each other. I know that didn't go together, and it's a different word, but praise each other. If you ever go through the Five Love Languages book, maybe you have, one of the love languages is words of affirmation. Do all of you like to have nice words said to you? Absolutely. Don't they sound a lot better when they come from your spouse? 100%. I was blessed this week with Heather giving me this verse. I think she learned it at the Tuesday ladies class in their discussions that they were having. But when I came home, she said, I really love Proverbs 11:25. So let's look at that verse first. Whoever brings a blessing will be enriched, and one who waters will himself be watered. One who gives a blessing will receive a blessing. Jesus kind of used this same idea, right? In the golden rule, treat others how you would like to be treated. If you want to hear encouraging words from your spouse, what should you do? Encourage your spouse. Shower them with blessings. Husbands, tell your wives how beautiful they are. Let them know, wow, the extra time you spent today in the bathroom preparing, you look amazing, right? You didn't do anything this morning and you look amazing. You just woke up and you look beautiful. I love you for that. Wives, compliment your husbands. They may not work out, but you can tell them they look strong, right? We got a lot of laughs on that one. Tell him he's handsome. Tell him he's your hero. Use that type of affirmation to build each other up, to enrich your marriages. Notice Proverbs 18:21, death and life are in the power of the tongue. Those who love it will eat its fruits. We want to encourage, because when we encourage each other and we're praising each other, we'll want to be around each other. We'll love the idea of being around our loved ones, because, hey, when I go up to my wife, she's going to tell me how strong I look, right? And wives are going to be like, I can't wait to go walk in and see my husband, because he's going to say, wow, you look beautiful today. We want to praise each other. But please also understand, we can praise others who aren't our spouse. When you see people in the lobby or walking down the mile-long hallways that we have, you can encourage them. You can praise them. You can let them know how wonderful they are and encourage them. Because if you want to be encouraged, you should encourage others also. Four commitments I would love for you to make this week to each other. Again, I have enjoyed this series talking about marriage, because it has blessed me in my marriage, and I hope it's blessed you in your marriage as well. As we end this series, I want to make sure that I let you know, if you are in need of help in your marriage, reach out to me, reach out to Travis, reach out to Cliff. We will find a way to help. We would love to always make sure we're bringing unity between couples. Maybe you have areas in your life, it's not between you and your spouse, or maybe you are currently without a spouse, but you said, I need help. I'm having division somewhere in my life, and I need to ask for prayers. We'd love to pray with you this morning. We would love to encourage you this morning. Or maybe you're here this morning, and you're ready to put on Christ in baptism. We got to see a baptism posted on Facebook this week from Jake Lifsey, and that is awesome. And we are thankful. But maybe someone else is here and they're ready to become a child of God and have their sins washed away. This morning can be that morning. I bet the water is still warm. Whatever you need, whatever help you may need this morning, we would love for you to come while we stand and sing the song of invitation.